So this was about the attributes. After defining those attributes, we defined the two rules, our two basic rules, which were that if you have two gamma matrices which are not in the canonical order, we told Mathematica to put them in the canonical order with the commutator. This was what it was. So replace delay, delayed replacement, only if A and B are not ordered. And then if the both A and A are equal, just replace by delta AA. Okay? Then we started using this notation where we have a function and then slash two dots. And this tells Mathematica what follows is a definition, a property of the function circle times. And what properties of circle times did we teach Mathematica? We taught that, her that the circle times is linear. So if you have circle times of A1 plus A2, that is just A1 times A3 plus A2 times A3. Okay, so distribute, it's linear under plus. It's linear if it's on the other side, of course. So a gamma matrix times another gamma matrix plus gamma matrix times another gamma matrix. And then we taught Mathematica that if you have, for example, a number times a gamma matrix times a gamma matrix, this gives the number times the product of the two gamma matrices. And what is this being a number? We say here, replace, do this if it's a number. And this numq was a function which we defined here, which would give true if we were thinking about delta functions or numbers. And otherwise, it would give false. Okay? So if we ask Mathematica what is numq, we can put question mark numq. She will tell us that numq, in this case, it's true, otherwise it's false. The file is in the intranet. If you don't have this output, please download it. And this was it. And we thought also that if you have a number with a gamma times a gamma matrix, that's just the number times the gamma matrix in the usual product sense, without the need for any funny symbol. And then when we apply these rules, with Mathematica knowing how circle times works, we got indeed that our example was simplified to this. Now, this is not yet fully simplified. So, first of all, everyone has this output now, right? Okay. So, this is not yet fully simplified because here I have C and C. I can replace this by a B, right? We are always assuming that there is a sum over repeated indices. So, of course, at the end, since we are summing over C, in this example, the final expression should not have any C. And indeed, we see that we should contract that thing over there. So we should get twice gamma A, gamma B from the first term, because this gamma C is just gamma B. And then minus gamma A, gamma B, and delta CC is the dimension, as we said before. Minus gamma A, gamma B times the dimension, which is, of course, 2 minus D times gamma A, gamma B, gamma A, gamma B. Okay? So let's now teach Mathematica these last steps of contracting the indices and giving us exactly the final result. Okay? Now, here we can still do by head. It's quite simple just to contract the indices like we did in the blackboard. But let's now enter something more complicated like this second example, where we have now more repeated indices. So let's see, what are the indices which are repeated? D is repeated, A appears twice as well, C appears twice as well, and B appears only once. So the final result, all indices should disappear except B, which only appears once. All other indices are summed over. We should be able to eliminate them. But if you compute example 2 and apply rule 1, comma rule 2, now, this will give this huge mess, and it's not so straightforward to do it in your head, all these contractions, right? We can expand, we can apply expand to this to eliminate the brackets, and these are the kind of things we need to simplify. Okay? So let's denote this, our goal. Let's call this goal. Our goal is to simplify this huge mess. Okay. Actually, I don't know why I defined it. I will not use it. Okay. So now, let's teach Mathematica how to contract indices. Okay? This is how to perform sums with delta AB. So let's define our final set of rules. The final set of rules. What are they? What are all the rules we want? First, we want rule 1. Let's put it here. We want rule 2. Okay, these were the previous ones, but now we want some more rules. We want to tell Mathematica that if she finds delta of A1, A1, this should be replaced by? By what? If you find delta with the same argument, A1, A1? Not 1, because there is a summation always over repeated indices. D. So let's call say, okay, D. Or, but D, there might be indices called D, let's call it dim dimension. By the way, why is dim black? Ah, because we still have the spins. So let's clear all dim, otherwise dim is 2. It's the dimension of the SC2 representation. We should really have quit the kernel in the beginning. But okay. Okay, so dim should be blue. Very good. What should we do if we find delta A1, A2 squared? We see that in this expression, gold disappears sometimes. Delta CD squared, for example, appearing here. What should we do in this case when we find delta with this case, delta CD squared?
Delta CD.
What?
Delta CD.
No?
I don't.
No. So delta CD square, delta, let's write in the notation of Mathematica to know what we are saying. So delta CD square, what is this in our human language? It's delta CD, delta CD. Right? Summation over the indices. So what is this? This is delta, you can sum over the index D, CC. So what is this? Dimension, right? So don't be fooled. So delta CD square is also the dimension. More generically, more complicated, the case is the case when you have A1, A2, and then something, A3. For example, when you have, let's look here, for example, this case here, in blue, you have BD, and then there's something else. A3 would be everything which multiplies this delta function. What do we want to do in this case? If you have delta BD times something else outside, what could you do to simplify it? How would you teach someone to do this rule? Then you have to teach a very young child how to do it. If you find some delta AB multiplying something, what should you do? Look at that something and do what to that something?
Replace.
So you should look at whatever multiplies delta BD, and if you find a B, put it to BD. That's what you should do. Is it clear? So let's tell her that. So replace this by, and we put now a bracket, A3, where A1 is replaced by A2. Notice a replacement inside a replacement. It's okay if we have delayed evaluation. We say that once you tell me what is A3, A1, and A2, this is what you should do. Give me A3, but there put A1 to be A2. Okay? But we should not do it all the time. We should do it if A3 does not have the element A1. If A3 does not have the element A1. If A3 has the element A1, then I might be doing mistakes. Wait, let me think 1 second. Let me write what's the correct replacement and then let's think about it. I only want to replace when it's not true that A3 does not have A1s. This is what it means. If you have 3Q, it means the following. If you have F of A, B, C, G of pi, comma 3, and you ask, is this expression free of B's? False. It has a B somewhere there. Is this expression free of Z's? True. There are no Z's there. So what we are saying is, do this replacement if A3 does not have A1s there. I'm a bit confused. Give me 1 second. So if you have delta, let's understand how this works. So we have something like delta CB. And now I want to multiply this by delta, for example, VA. Okay? So this is what we would call A1, this is A2, and all this stuff would be A3. Now what we are telling is that this, we know, should go to delta CA, right? What is delta CA? It's A3, where we replace, which one? We replace A2 by A1. Okay? And we want to do it. We want to replace this D by C and not C by D. So what's the rule? I replace the one which is not there, which is D. So I want to replace A2 by A1 if, this should be delayed, if A3 does not contain C. So does not contain, so free Q, A3, if A3 doesn't contain C, and C was A1.
Isn't it to say if it contains D? Because if it doesn't contain either C or D, you don't replace anything.
But it's not a problem. It will just... it will not do anything. It's okay. No. I think you're absolutely right. So free Q means it doesn't contain. Good. Free Q means, of course, free Q. It's true if it doesn't contain A1. So that's not what I want to say. I want to say A2 here. So this is does not contain A2, so this means contains A2. It's exactly what you are saying. So this is true if A3 does not, it's free, we are asking whether it's free, does not contain A2. And now we are asking not, we are negating this. So this stuff means it contains A2. Okay? So, and the only thing I did there was I changed who is called A1 and A2. But this is exactly what I did. Right? I could decide to call this A2, A1, and then I will change here 1, 2. Okay? This was a bit slightly trickier. It just tells that we have delta function times something. And if, as Babak was saying, if that something contains one of the indices of the delta function, then replace that index by the other one of the delta function to get rid of one of the indices. Okay? Good. This was a bit, so maybe we should put a comment here. Let's say, if A3 contains one of the indices of the delta function, replace that index by the other index of the delta function. Index or index? Index. Of the top. Okay. So these are our rules. These are our set of rules. Now we can pick our second example, which was this example, much more complicated. And we can apply this rule many times, rule, and simplify the final result. And this is what we get. Okay? Did everyone get this? I think something like this will take hours to do by hand, as I would imagine. And it will be impossible to do without sign mistakes. Sorry? X2 was this complicated example here. I will copy it down. You want me to explain again this replacement here? Should I, do you think it's better if I go over it again? Okay, so let me read it. So if I have two delta functions, or if I have a delta function times something, if this something contains d, I want to replace d by c. This way I get rid of one index. I have c, d, and d, and now I get rid of one of the indices.
So you're replacing d in both of them?
No. This thing is being replaced just by this. So I have delta of a1, a2, and then I have multiplied by something by a3. At the end of the day, I will get just a3. Delta function disappears. Right? If a3 contains the index a2, then I replace a2 by a1, and I get rid of the delta function. So I'm just saying that if you have delta a1, a2, and some tensor with many indices, and one of them is a2, replace this by f a1. This is what that function does. Okay? So this is what this last replacement does. If you have some tensor with one of the indices is a2, replaced by a1. Yes?
I'm just a little confused about having mathematically realized that the delta function is the variable a3. Is that because we defined it as a number?
No. The mathematical doesn't recognize a3 as being... Mathematical looks for a pattern where you have delta with two arguments multiplied something. Something doesn't need to be a single block. This something can be a very complicated thing, like product of many delta functions and gamma functions. It can be gamma function, can be whatever.
We've said it's a3 in our definition.
Which is just A3. It's whatever multiplies delta of A1, A2. Whatever. It can be many gamma functions. It can be... It is basically this, right? It's an object which has many indices up, many indices. Many in this case, it's Euclidean, we only have indices down. It has many indices, and it can be delta functions times gamma functions times everything.
Can this something that you multiply the function with can be in front of the delta function?
In front, or... Yeah, it can be both. Yeah, because Mathematica knows that the product is commutative.
Oh yeah, we need some term.
So Mathematica knows that it's delta function times something else. And notice that here I don't need to teach what happens if it's A2, A1, A2 and not A1, which is present, and stuff like this. Nothing like this I need to teach because Mathematica knows that delta function is orderless. So I don't need to teach that if A3 contains A2 and not A1, etc. This I don't need to do because the delta function is orderless. Okay? Does everyone get this as output?
No.
No.
No, the slash rule means apply rules as many times as you need.
Didn't you say you had to change that to A2 though? A3, A1?
No, I will just, it's exactly the same because I have A1 here, but I also have A1 going to A2, not A2 going to A1.
just changing y call a one and it. Okay. Did it work? Is it work? No? So in this row, everyone got table as well? Here as well? Here? Yeah? Is it working? Is it working here? Eduardo, is it already working? Is it working? Okay, very good. So, general questions about Mathematica. Is there something in particular you would like to ask about? Are there any questions you would like to know? I could discuss some of the problems that I asked you to do yesterday. I could tell you how to parallelize in Mathematica.
Can we do the parallel thing?
The parallelize? Okay. So, let's see what's better. So, do you have the notebook where we did the exact diagonalization? So let's open the notebook. I can just show you, I mean, it's not something that you need to be following in detail. So here is the program that we did the other day. So let me quit the kernel, evaluation, quit kernel, local. Let me just, before moving on, emphasize that I do recommend that you, during the following lectures that you will have during the Psi program, try to play with Mathematica and to use it efficiently to simplify algebra and what we have seen with the gamma functions, I'm sure can be very useful in many, many circumstances during the course. Okay, but let's see what we have done before, because I want to explain just this parallelize, so let me again remind you what we did. Let me just... Okay. So in this document I already have the parallelize implemented, so let me show you how it works. So I have my spins, as you remember. This was the dimension of the spins. Then I was checking that the commutation relations are okay, but we know they are okay. We don't care about this. We don't care about this. Okay? So we had our Pauli matrices. Then we had our tensor product, which was just circle times. We checked that the eigenvalues of Si of S squared with two spins were okay. Then we define the identity matrix. In this case, you see I'm using a slightly different notation. Before we were using this slash DSI, and now I'm using ID, but that's the same. Again, try to follow what I'm explaining, but of course I'm not asking you to copy everything. And then we did this large volume extrapolation. That's the interesting part. So we define some maximum, and then we ask Mathematica to have this HS to compute this table of Hamiltonians. Right? And then, okay, this was HS, and this was the table of Hamiltonians, which took me 9 seconds. Then I said that you could do it a bit better. You could define this HS2. Let me erase this and I want to explain. So you could define this sparse array, and with sparse array it was much faster, and indeed it takes 100 times, it's 100 times faster for me. Okay? So is everyone following the logic? Of course I'm not asking you to come, but this was something we saw the other day. So how would we parallelize this computation? You have four cores in your computers, and you might want Mathematica
to do in each different score one of these eigenvalues, to diagonalize one of these Hamiltonians in a different score. And you might want not to be computing in series. First compute the first eigenvalue, then the second, then the third, etc. You might want to take Mathematica distribute them through your four processors of your computers and have Mathematica use the four of them. Okay? The way we will do is the following. First, we will teach Mathematica to distribute definitions, and we will tell Mathematica to tell all the kernels what is this HS2, which is this, as you remember, it's this vector of Hamiltonians, right? It's this vector of Hamiltonians. Each of them, Mathematica thinks in this way, it's a sparse array. And we want to tell Mathematica to teach all the kernels this definition, and not only the kernel that we are currently using. And this, we use distributed definitions of HS2. And now, what we can do is simply run exactly the same, now that the distributions are now that this definition is distributed, and we will just put parallelize, and we will just apply parallelize to this table. Okay? And we can check how long it takes, and it takes longer because it's launching my two kernels, and just because of launching the kernels, it took 2 seconds. But if the computation would be very long, if it would be, for example, the analyzation of it would go up to 14 by 14, then it would be considerably fast. Here it took a bit longer because it was such a trivial test, 0.01 seconds, that it takes longer just to call the kernels, distribute, give them tests to do, right? It's the kind of thing that it's easier if you do it yourself than if you ask someone else to do it, right? But of course, in many circumstances, you can imagine that this can be much faster.
Sure.
There is a nicer way of doing it, because sometimes you don't trust very much parallelize, and because parallelize can do very wrong things. For example, if you have a table, and if what you want to parallelize is some operation, if inside the table you have some other table, and what you want to parallelize is the operations done inside the table, Mathematica can be quite bad with it. Mathematica will not know exactly what's the best way of parallelizing. She will not look at the code if the code is complicated and think, oh, this is the best way to split the code into and to send this to two processors. In a table, it's quite simple. What she does is each element of the table is computed in a different kernel. But if you have a more complicated situation, it can be a bit more complicated. So let me show you something which is a bit more general than this parallelizing of a table. What I can do, and often this is what you need. So often what happens is the following. Here, HS2 is already a matrix of numbers. But sometimes, this HS2 is a function which came after a long, very long computation. And you have some output. And what you can do is, if you want to distribute, you would basically have to distribute a full notebook to all the kernels. And this is extremely tough. So what you can do is you save the output. So the way to save the output is the following. You click HS2, and you save it. And to save it, you put this symbol, and then you put save.notebook. And this is creating a notebook where this HS2 is saved. Okay? I run it, and now there is such notebook. And then I can, for example, ask in a separate file, so let's open a new Mathematica, and let's ask for save.notebook. This gives me my table of Hamiltonians. Let's ask for element 1 of this table. And this gives this sparse array. And we can ask to put in normal, to see the normal matrix, and here is the matrix. So you see, I saved it, I was working in another notebook, and then I just saved these big matrices that I want to diagonalize, I don't care how I got it. And now, I can just open them, and it's completely independent. So this is great to parallelize, because I have a program there, and I have there a vector of elements, and I don't care about the previous history, how I got it. Right? So I can even parallelize it in this other notebook. So what I would do is I would ask to compute the eigenvalues of this object here. I would click this and ask for the element L minus 1. Okay, sorry, not 1, but L minus 1. Okay. I would go from L equals 2 to I want these eigenvalues of, eigenvalues of this matrix. The first eigenvalue, this was the ground state. Okay? Then, you remember, we have to pick one, because if we ask for this without this one, it gave a table. So, because we want a number, we put this one. This was this one. Then we want to make a table of these values, L and then this. Okay? We want to do this for several L's, okay? And to submit these operations to different kernels. So what you can do is the following. Let me write and you'll see how it works. You have a table of parallel submissions. And you put L here, this is the syntax. And again, I can give you this if you want. This parallel submits this operation. And then I say L goes from 2 to the maximum. The maximum is what? Length of this object. This save this matrix. You remember max was 10, so the length should be 9. Okay, so we would go up to this length. Okay. And this is what we want to call a prepare. This is our preparation. And this is how it looks like. So we run, and here they are, couple of operations prepared to, for being submitted. So there is one operation here, which is compute the eigenvalues with L equals 2, compute the eigenvalue with L equals 3, compute the eigenvalue with L equals 4. And it's all prepared to be submitted. Okay? And now, what I can do is say TB is submit all this stuff, which is wait all of this preparation. And I can ask what is the absolute timing of this. And now, Mathematica will submit this process. It was too fast. So let's run it again. This. And now when I run, this stuff should change, start changing colors. And indeed, see, it's running. And as it's running, they are changing colors, telling it was computed. And this is how it was. And it took 0.35 seconds. For example, I remember that I saved at some point a file which was Hamiltonians, ham. And this Hamiltonian, see, it keeps exactly the same thing, but the difference is that I ran up to 12. You remember the other day I told you it could run, but it will take a while. Let me show you that the length of this is 11. So there are two more. So now, for this one, it will be a bit tougher to diagonalize, so maybe I gain some time. I can run Hamiltonian. Now it runs up to 12. Now there are more operations, you see, there is L from 2 to 11, and now I can ask again to run, and it's running this in different kernels. And I only have 2 kernels, you would have 4, because you have 4 kernels.
We only have licenses for 2, though,
I only have licenses for 2, okay. So, okay, I'm being recorded, I can say no. Okay. So, okay, very good. So this was about parallelizing. I did it in a different notebook. Of course, I could do it in this notebook. It will change now. Okay, I can then give you this notebook if you are interested. Of course, it's a bit fancier. But if you are interested in heavy numerical computation, this is it. Okay. Does it answer your question, Felix?
Yeah.
So, any other questions about how to use Mathematica? So, since we have some time left, maybe I will tell you how to solve one of the hard problems, since some of you tried and it was hard. Okay. And then I will show you how to do it in Mathematica, because this was, of course, problems for Mathematica. You need, at some point, you need to solve it numerically, but the first part is analytic. So let me show you, for example, how to find an analytic function. So let's solve, for example, this hard problem. Y of u plus I over 2 times y of u minus I over 2 is equal to 1 plus y of u. And the boundary conditions for these functional equations was We said we had this strip where the function was analytic. The size of this strip was 2. I said it's analytic up to 1 and from minus 1. And we said that as we go to infinity inside the strip, at infinity inside the strip, y of u, is e to the minus m cos of u. Okay. This means that log of y of u, okay, sorry. This means that the function y of u over e to the minus m cos theta, let's define this function to be x of u, cos of u, sorry. Let's define this function to be I'm sorry. I hope this was not too tough for you. Was this the this is actually not so correct. Was this the problem? There was no pi missing because there must be a pi here or a pi in the I over 2. Otherwise, it doesn't really make sense.
That was the problem.
Was there a pi here?
No.
Yeah.
Was there a pi in the I over 2?
No.
Then you should have complained because then it's obvious that it doesn't make sense because then how could this function be... Okay, let's see why this makes sense only with this pi here. Okay? Sorry about that. So, let's see that at infinity this is possible. Indeed, y of u plus I over 2 behaves as e to the minus m cos of pi times u plus I over 2 at infinity. Okay? Y of u minus I over 2 at infinity behaves as e to the minus m cos of pi u minus I over 2. This is what? I never know. So this is I, this is e to the minus m I sinh of pi u. And this is e to the plus m I sinh of pi u. Okay? Yes? So when I multiply both, so this is at infinity, indeed, y of u plus I over 2 times y of u minus I over 2 is approximately equal to 1. And this is consistent because on the right-hand side we have 1 plus y of u, and because y in the real axis is exponentially suppressed, this is also approximately equal to 1. Because in the real axis, this guy is very small. It's e to the minus m cos theta. Okay? Okay. So at least it was easy to see that the problem was not well defined if there was no pi. So I hope that you didn't lose much time with it if you saw this typo. Because of course it could not behave in that way as it was. So either I can put the shift here by pi and then I don't need a pi here, or I should put the pi in this cosh. Whatever I want. Because I need these two guys to cancel, because at infinity I know that y is very small. Okay. Any question here? So now we can consider this function x of u. Now, as u goes to infinity, x of u goes to 1, and therefore this log of this x of u goes to 0. So log of x of u decreases at infinity. Okay. So this log of x of u, it's analytic, this was one of the hypotheses, and decreases at infinity. also notice that x of u plus I over 2 times x of u minus I over 2 is the same as y of u plus I over 2 times y of u minus I over 2. Because exactly that, because this factor here, as we saw, just cancels when I do this opposite shifts. Okay? Y has the advantage of decreasing at infinity. But if I want to take the log, x is better because x decays at infinity. So let's take the log of this equation using x instead of y in the left-hand side. So we have log of x of u plus I over 2 plus log of x of u minus I over 2 is equal to log of 1 plus y of u. Now, this is an analytic function, so we can now use this result that I told you yesterday, that if we have an analytic function which decreases at infinity, and which is analytic inside some strip, we can take its Fourier transform, and its Fourier transform is trivially related to the Fourier transform of the function itself. So now, we Fourier transform and we get that the Fourier transform of log of x, from this factor I get e to the omega over 2, and from that factor here, plus e to the minus omega over 2, is equal to the Fourier transform of log of 1 plus y. Which means that the Fourier transform of log of x is equal to 1. This function is just 1 over 2 cos of omega over 2. No, this is just exponential plus exponential is cos, times the Fourier transform of log of 1 plus y, which is also a function of omega, of course. Now, a product of two Fourier transforms, what happens when I go back to position space? Becomes what? Becomes a convolution, right? A product of two Fourier transforms back in position space is a convolution. Is this okay for everyone? Yeah? Good, so I Fourier transform back. Now we do f minus 1. And we get that log of x of u is equal to the integral du prime k of u minus u prime convoluted with log 1 plus y of u prime, where k is the inverse Fourier transform of 1 over cos of omega, where k of u is now the inverse Fourier transform of 1 over 2 cos of omega over 2. And if you do this inverse Fourier transform, just need to compute an integral, it is given by 1 over 2 pi cos of pi theta. It's a funny function, it's its own Fourier transform up to some function. There are not that many, right? There is the Gaussian, there is this one. I don't know that many. I don't even know if it's simple to find all functions which are their own Fourier transforms. I don't know if you ever thought about it. I did not. Okay, anyway, this is the Fourier transform of this function. And therefore, if we now use back what is the definition of x in terms of y, because we don't want two functions, then we get the following equation, log of y of u is equal to minus m cos of pi u plus integral du prime over 2 pi cos of u of pi u minus u prime t- times log of 1 plus y of u prime. Okay? So we just transformed a functional equation plus analytic properties into an integral equation. Why is this better? Because now this function y and this function y are both in the real axis, and this is an equation which is easy to solve, numerically at least. It's not like the other one, which was some fancy functional equation, you have no idea how to start even trying to solve it. For example, if m is large, this y of u is approximately given by e to the minus m cosh of pi u. It's very small. So this is very small. Okay? And then 1 plus y is very small. Because it's log of 1. And this integral of this k times this log of 1 plus y is negligible. And this is a consistent solution. So we see that the leading order solution is this. Y is just e to the minus m cosh theta. This goes through. This is equal to this, and this guy is subleading. It's just something very small. So what should you do to find the solution at the generic for m, which is large but not that large? Well, you start with this solution, which is the leading order solution. Then you plug it here, and you get in this way a new y. Then you plug it back here, and you get in this way an updated y. And you continue plugging into this convolution and getting out the new y. Okay? So what we should do in Mathematica is we should do the following. Say that to leading order, y0 is equal to e to the minus m cosh of pi u, and then yn, the nth one, is e to the minus m cosh of pi u plus integral du prime over 2 pi cosh of pi u minus u prime times log of 1 plus y n minus 1 of u. Okay? And then at some point this converges. And of course, our y function exact is probably, unless it doesn't converge, would be the infinite one. Okay? This is how you would solve. You would just plug it in Mathematica and compute it several times. Okay? Before showing you the solution in Mathematica, I will do this in another way. First of all, are there questions? Does someone want me to do something in more detail?
What is that letter on the board right there
after
the
U? K.
Okay, what is it?
K is the inverse Fourier transform of 1 over 2 cosh. Are all the steps clear? Yeah? So it doesn't... Yeah? Why do we have n minus 1? No, this is, we are solving by iteration, so this is the leading order. What's the first correction? y1, you put the y0 here and see what you get, and this gives you a better estimate for the left-hand side. And then you get something a bit better, which is not just m cos theta, but something correct. Then you plug it again and you get the new one, etc. Okay. Is there any conceptual doubts? Anything biting you? Let me do it in another way. Let's not use Fourier transforms. Okay? Some of you might not remember that Some of you might not remember that the Fourier, that all this stuff about convolutions and Fourier transforms, so let me do it without using Fourier transforms. Can I erase? So let's start from this equation where we have log of x of u plus I over 2, etc. Let's consider, yes?
How do you get the y n?
The y n, I know if I know the previous y. This is, I'm solving by iterations. If you tell me y0, I get y1. I put n equal 1, I get y1. Then I get y2 by using y1, etc.
Okay, I thought you got it from taking the explanation of the exact.
So this equation here is exact, but no one can solve it exactly. It's a nonlinear integral equation, there's no way you can solve this exactly. Now, there are various ways of solving it, by Newton method, by several methods. I'm just claiming that if the mass is large, this term you can ignore, so this is a very good approximation. Therefore, you can start from this, if you have some reasonably large mass, and then just iterate it slowly. If you want now to start decreasing the mass, you have two options. Either you repeat the same stuff, or you use the last value from the last, after it last converged, when the mass was closed, as your starting point. Right? It doesn't really matter what's the starting point. So if you now, this could be a starting point when the mass is large. Then I do many iterations and I get the final y. Now I decrease a bit the mass. Maybe it's better to start from the last guy here instead of starting from this. But that's the question of how you want to implement it numerically. Provided it converges, it's the same thing. Yes?
Is it like easy to see that that map is a contraction that you will really like converge and you will really get a solution by doing this?
Because of what I said. Because if the mass is large, you know that you can ignore the second term and you know that it's a very good solution everywhere with exponential precision. So then you know that at least if the mass is large, you will converge. Then you know that the solutions are continuous. So you converge in some large region of masses. Then you can always use the last value when it converged for your next iteration. But then you are very close to the result if you are decreasing the mass slowly. But actually this method converges for masses n to the minus 10 to the minus 8. It's perfect. I will show you in Mathematica how to implement this in practice. It's a very simple problem now, right? Just start with this and compute y n according to this. Now the problem that we want to solve is just this box. This is what we've given for Mathematica. Yes?
How do you get that relation between the x's and the y's?
From the definition of the x's. X of u was y of u over e to the minus m cos of phi u, right? So when you apply x of u plus I over 2 times x of u minus I over 2, the exponential cancels because it gives plus sinh and minus sinh.
You understand?
That's exactly how I saw that the asymptotics were okay. Because they cancelled and it was 1. So another way of doing it, which is more or less, which is kind of orthogonal to this Fourier way, but which is of course equivalent and which uses more complex analysis, is by looking, by applying a particular kernel, which is of course our k, to this equation. But what will be our motivation? The statement is the following. Let's consider more general than this. Let's say that we have g of u plus I over 2 plus g of u minus I over 2. In this case, this g is log of x. Where this g is some bounded analytic function in the strip where between minus 1/2 imaginary part of u and 1/2. Our x of u is better even. It goes to 0, so it certainly is bounded, it's more than bounded. And it was analytic in a bigger strip. Okay? So we are certainly in this condition. And let's consider the problem when you want to solve. This is equal to some f of u. How do you invert this operation? Now the claim is that the inverse of this operation is given, which might be non-trivial that you can do it, is that the inverse is given by the following. You apply k to this, g of u plus I over 2 plus g of u minus I over 2. This star means convolution. And the claim is that this k inverts this shift and gives just g of u. It's a funny operator, this k. This k is the operator 1 over 2 pi cosh of pi u, and we can call it the inverse shift operator. It undoes shifts of analytic functions in this way. Let's see why k has this nice property of undoing shifts of analytic functions. So let's prove it. Okay, so let's prove it. So the proof is the following. Let's write explicitly what the left-hand side is. So we have integral d u prime over 2 pi, and then here cosh of u minus u prime with pi, and then here g of u plus I over 2 plus g of u minus I over 2. Okay? What do you suggest that I do now? Suggestions. I want to massage this expression. What do you suggest? Can someone suggest something? Some idea?
We have two zeros and then...
Very good. Let's split it in two integrals and make a change of variable to say that if u plus I over 2 is u prime and u minus I over 2 is u prime. So let's change variable. So this, here it was u prime. It's a convolution. Okay? Let's call this v. And then this v, what does it mean? We are integrating now over v, which is a real number, plus I over 2. And if we call this v as well, when splitting into two integrals, we are integrating over the real axis minus I over 2. And when you do this change of variable, this cosh becomes what? When we change this, it becomes either sinh or minus sinh. Right? Because you shift u to be v, u prime to be v plus I over 2, and it flips a cosh into a sinh. So what you do when you do this change of variables is that you get an integral. Instead of going over the real axis, now, here is the real axis, and the integral goes like this, and then comes back like this. Now, this is the v-plane. This was the u-prime plane. dv over 2 pi I, and I appears because cosh becomes I sinh, as we saw before. And then what appears here is sinh of pi v over, sinh of pi u minus v over g of v. Okay? So we just integrate, but now over this contour, which goes down and then comes up. Okay? Is it okay? Should I do it one step slower? Is it okay? But now, our assumption was that g was analytic in the strip. So there are no poles in the strip for g. And there is one pole here when u is equal to v. So we can compute this by this residue at this pole. So this is just g of u, which is the residue of sinh. The residue at u equal to v. Okay? So we got exactly what we wanted. That indeed, this kernel for analytic functions undoes these shifts and gives just g of u. A pi? Good. So it means that when I wrote that the inverse Fourier transform of that kernel, because I'm used to another normalization, there is no pi here. Okay, so the kernel is just 1 over 2 cosh. So there is no pi here, and exactly as Bruno said, the residue gives the extra pi that we need. So k of u, there is no pi here. If we will do the Fourier transform carefully, there will be no pi. Okay? So this would be the residue at u equal to v. But then, what we need to do is to apply k to this equation. And if we apply k to that equation, we get then that log of x of u, the k destroys that shift, is equal to k convoluted with log of 1 plus y. And now if you use what the x is in terms of y, you get the previous equation. So this is exactly the same equation as before. Okay? So again, when doing this change of variable, here, what you would get when doing from here to here, you have two terms. One, for example, the first one is integral dv over 2 I sinh or cosh, if you want, of pi u minus v minus I over 2 over g of v. Where v, because we change this variable, is integrated along minus the real axis plus I over 2. And this is nothing but I shift minus by minus I sinh of pi u minus v. Okay, so for both terms you get this. And if you are careful with the signs, you get that one of them is in this direction and the other there is a minus and it's in that direction. And of course, we are using the fact that it's bounded at infinity, I forgot to mention, to claim that we can close the contour here. That's why it was very important to use x. Okay, so we are using this statement that if the function is bounded, decays at, or is bounded at infinity, we can close the contour and therefore get just the pole inside that strip, which is precisely g. Okay, so then we derive this equation. This equation is exactly equivalent to the other one there. Okay, so this is how you will derive it using complex analysis instead of Fourier transforms. Okay, so how would we implement those equations in Mathematica? How would we implement those equations in Mathematica? Should I show you or should we do at the same time? I think probably you already did enough, I would say. Yeah? Can I just show you how the code? So here is the program. Let me explain you how it is. Let me just show you first with the usual zoom so that you see it's not that big. It's just this. Ah. You can see it's not that big. You almost don't see it. So this is the program. So it starts there, and this is already the plot of the functions converging. So let's go through it. So what's the logic here? And I can put the notebook on the internet. So let me run this for you and see. Let's quit the kernel, local, quit, and let's erase the output so that we'll be happy when it appears. Okay. So what we do here, let's start by understanding this part here. So here I define my kernel, 1 over 2 pi cosh of x. So I'm using the normalization where the pi is in the shifts of the functional equations. But if you want to do the one we were doing in the lecture, I will put a pi here and no pi here. But I don't want to do it. Let me explain. Okay. But I don't want to do it. And then I'm choosing some mass, for example, m equal 1. Sorry, I called it mass. Some m equal 1. I'm calling it mass because in the physical problems that this arises, this is the mass of some relativistic particles. And this y functions gives you the exact ground state energy of some physical system. Okay. And now I define this x. Can someone try to guess what this x would be? So it's r cosh of 7 log of 10 over m. Does someone have any idea what could I be doing with this x? Absolutely. So this is the value when e to the minus exponential e to the minus m cosh of pi x is equal to 10 to the minus 10. No? It's more? What have I done? So arcosh. I don't put pi here. Okay? This is the it's a value where this exponential is already very small. Because I will not integrate from minus infinity to infinity. I will have some cutoff. This is what this x is. And I will choose this cutoff to be a value where these exponentials, which govern the decay of the functions, is already very small. Okay? So if I would like to put an 8 here, then the cutoff would be the value where it would be 10 to the minus 8. Okay? But 10 to the minus 7 is more than enough. 10 to the minus 5 would be perfect, actually. Okay? So here I'm defining my kernel, I'm setting a mass, and I'm defining a cutoff for solving the integral equation. Okay, good. Next, let's go down. We will do the upper part first. And here we clear y. And we define the following. Okay, let me increase the zoom. So here is the k, and here is this part here now with the y's. We say that y0 is exponential. Ignore this f for a moment. It's exponential of minus m cos theta. And yk, and you see here I have this memorization. I compute yk and I save it. Obviously, here I would be insane if I would not do it, right? Because I want to compute for 6 knowing the fifth one. I don't want, when I'm asking Mathematica to compute the sixth one, I don't want to compute the fifth, the fourth, the third, etc., if I already did it. So I want to save these values. And what are these values? They are exponential minus m cos theta plus the integral of this kernel with this log y of the previous step. This is k minus 1. So k minus 1 is n. K is n minus 1 and k is n. Okay? So you understand what's the idea here. And then, what I do is I compute this table and of the y functions and I plot them. But now let's look at the subtleties now. So this was the bulk. Let's understand, for example, what is this f here? What was this f? Now the idea is the following. At each value, at each iteration, you must have some function that you want to integrate. You must have some y, n minus 1, that you want to integrate. So, but what you will do is, you will compute that value, you will compute this, at several values of u, between minus the cutoff and plus the cutoff, and get several points. And now you want to make a function which goes through those points, and that's the function at the step n. And then you use that function for the next iteration. So what you do again is you compute this for many points and you don't get a function. You get a collection of points. Tuck, 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 tuck. Now you tell her to create a function which goes through those points. That's our approximation for our function. And that's the function that we use in the next step because we need to integrate. We are not happy with just having collections of points. We need functions. Okay? We could, but why?
It will just make it much slower.
No, what we are doing is compute that many points and create a function which goes through those many points and then integrate. Integrate mathematically will do it numerically. Right?
It's all numerically?
Yeah.
So why are we certain way?
Because we don't want to write the integral as a sum. We want to give Mathematica integrates numerically but integrates functions. When I ask Mathematica integrate numerically this, I should give her a function. Not a function times a set of points. Of course, I could use that set of points and do myself some integration, define myself some integration routine. But that would be much longer. It's much simpler to just give her a numerical function times an analytic function and tell her to integrate. Right?
Numerical integration, some advanced techniques, first interpolate and then integrate. So that's the same. You wouldn't have numerical integration.
Yes. Numerical integration, what Mathematica will do exactly, if you ask for numerical integration of complicated function, Mathematica will do exactly this. First discretize, then create some set of data, create some interpolating function which is numerically, and then use some optimization methods to dealing with polynomials, because the integration of polynomials and these interpolating functions is much faster. So how do we create this interpolating function? So what f is doing, you see, is f is a function which asks for a function of x, computes x at several points, and then gives an interpolating function, which goes through those points.
That's exactly what we are going to do here. For example, in the beginning we didn't need because it's an analytic function. But what I'm doing here is I'm taking this function of x, computing the function of x at several points, and then creating a numerical function which goes to those points. Then I'm doing it again here. I'm telling mathematics, compute this stuff, in particular compute this integral for several values of x, get several values, and then create a function out of all these points. So let's see how this f looks like. So f is simple. It's a function interpolation of s. Okay? So if this just tells Mathematica to do all this that is said by words, pick whatever you put there, run x between minus cutoff and cutoff with 250 points, and create a function which goes through those points. Then I also have a function int, which tells you that integrate whatever you give me when y runs from minus x to x. So you see, I'm using variable y for integration, variable x to be a free variable that we are going to interpolate. Okay. And there is a bug in Mathematica, and let me show you first how it works, and it's funny. So I would run this to interpolate my data. I would ask my y's, and for example, I could ask, give me a table of the y functions. You see, y1 up to y6. You see, I have the argument here. For y, this is a variable. Apply this from 0 up to 6. This gives me the first 6 y functions. Okay, and I could ask, and it gives this error. It's just confused because of orders of when I give her x and y, but the output is perfectly fine. This is just, she's being overcautious. So what we do is we tell her to shut up. And this, we turn off this error message. Okay? People from Wolfram don't like that when we do this. And when we do it, she just shuts up, and the result is perfect. And now we can just plot these functions and see that as we plot, the blue one is the first one, and as we are doing more and more iterations, the functions are converging. And the last one, you see that they are becoming dense around some final result. And this will be our final y function. This will be our outcome. Okay, so is it clear? So this is the full code. So we have some function interpolation, some n integrates. At each step, we define a new function. It's important to memorize the previous values, otherwise it will be painful. And then we are making a table of the functions from 0 up to 6. And then we are plotting the functions. Yeah? Well, now I hope it doesn't look that hard. I said it was a hard problem, but finally, apparently it was an easy one. Okay, so I'll put this in the wiki. I would probably say that we can stop here. I mean, I could show you how to do the other hard problem. I could answer questions about mathematics or Mathematica, but whatever you prefer. Oh, but I think we are done. I think you already learned enough. If you absorb everything I told you, it's quite a lot. So let me just give you some surveys. These are quite important because I ask you here whether you would have preferred more Mathematica, more group theory, etc. So please, this will be helpful if I will be giving the course next year to help me. Thank you.